I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. For more than two decades, our guest today, Catherine Coleman Flowers, has dedicated her life and career to fighting for environmental justice. Much of her work has focused on improving sanitation and water infrastructure in Black, Indigenous, Latino, and low-income rural communities throughout the United States. In her first book, Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret, she chronicled her journey to bring economic justice to her community in Lowndes County, Alabama, which has suffered from failing and inadequate water systems. And now she's out with a new memoir titled Holy Ground, on activism, environmental justice, and finding hope. The book is an inspiring collection of personal and political essays that really help chart a path toward equity, respect, and a just future. She writes in one excerpt from the book, "So often when I visit poor communities, and this is true of urban areas as well as rural ones, the feeling of despair and alienation is so powerful. One of the well-known paradoxes of our interconnected world, where information is so immediately accessible and social networks pretend to create community, is that people feel more divided, more isolated, and often more anxious and depressed than ever before. The time when my grandparents and their children would sit and listen to the reassuring voice of President Roosevelt over the radio is in the very distant past. Behind that voice, however, was real action, a real recognition that it was a responsibility of the government to address problems and make the lives of individual Americans better. And helping one person's life to improve, the lives of others could improve as well. Yes, those times are long gone, but the need for hope in a better future remains. And life has shown me that hope can sometimes appear in the most unlikely places." Wonderful and inspiring words from our guest, Catherine Coleman Flowers, a leading environmental activist, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice, and author of the new book, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. Welcome to the program, Catherine, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I also want to let our listeners know that Catherine will be in San Francisco on Tuesday, February 25th, for a noon event at the Commonwealth Club. And you can find out more information on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, Catherine, you've written this book at a time when the country is now going through a major stress test. And almost all the issues that you write about in the book, from environmental justice to environmental protection laws and regulations, to issues like abortion and voting rights, children's health and well-being, they're all now under serious attack. So how are you reflecting on where we are today, given the themes of your book?
Well, what is interesting is that I started writing a book in 2023. And it seems like some of the handwriting was on the wall. But I thought that my experiences could give people hope at a time when it was needed, and just reflecting on how we've gone through some of these periods before, maybe not all at one time, but some of these issues have been under attack before, and we thought we had resolved them, and here we are again. I think that these stories, my personal journey, could hopefully give people the strength to hold on, keep fighting, and move past and make the change that's necessary to get us where we need to be.
Well, in a way, it almost sounds like you almost had a premonition that this moment would arrive, that this book and this message of hope would be needed in what would otherwise become a dark time, given when you started it. Was that animating you, this prospect that even though we had a different presidential administration when you started the book, that we would be entering into potentially these challenging times?
Well, you know, I think what inspired me was, you know, the story of Judas, which I started to... That was initially what led me to write this group of essays, when I started thinking about Judas and the story of Judas, and then seeing what was happening on the political front with politicians unabashedly accepting money to do things that they weren't supposed to do, and not thinking about the communities that sent them there in the first place. And that was largely part of my inspiration. And then also seeing what was happening, the attacks on women's rights, reproductive rights, and especially that resonates with me because I shared the story of my own mother who was sterilized. My mother was in her 20s when she was sterilized. And there are just so many, there were so many things that were showing up that were warning signs. And I thought that I really wanted this book to come out before the election, but because I wanted people to think before they made a choice. But, you know, things being the way it was in the business, it came out afterwards. So I think it makes it even more important now as people are filled with these onslaught of things happening and not knowing what to do.
Well, such a deeply personal book, and as you referenced just there, you go through your mom's history of sterilization and connecting these injustices to what's happening all over the country, really all over the world. And I'm wondering if you could just summarize for listeners what you would see as the key message of hope, despite all these challenges and injustices. There is this message of hope that comes through, and I'm just wondering if in your own mind you could sort of summarize what that would be in the themes in this book.
Well, for me, how I would summarize it is that if a poor black girl from Lowndes County, Alabama, one of the poorest counties in the United States, located between Selma and Montgomery, could become a MacArthur Genius Fellow, coming from a poor school system. My father had an 11th grade education, but he was one of the smartest persons that I knew. My mother had a high school education. And for me to accomplish the things that I've accomplished that people thought were not possible, that makes me hopeful.
And what was it like to grow up there? I mean, that is such a strong underpinning of your values, your worldview. What was it like to grow up in Lowndes County? Can you talk more about the conditions there?
Well, first of all, Lowndes County was where my father was from originally. He grew up there. It's a very, very rural area between Selma and Montgomery, and its history was such that Hassan Jeffries, who wrote the book Bloody Lowndes, characterized the county as such because that's what it was known as. So much so that it is the home of the original Black Panther Party, not the one that is well known for the Bay Area, but the original Black Panther Party was a political party that grew out of Lowndes County and the desire of local people to be able to vote. And they had been denied the right to vote. And after the Voting Rights Act, they organized their own political party because they couldn't run as Democrats or Republicans at that particular time. But they set the stage to elect black elected officials not only in Lowndes County, but throughout the state of Alabama. So the way people were suppressed was through violence. So I grew up at a time when it was not very safe to speak out, but my parents were activists and we often entertain activists in our homes. So I grew up with a desire to make change, but to also do it in a peaceful way because I was influenced by Dr. King, because Dr. King had been in Montgomery. And of course, one of the famous marches was the march from Selma to Montgomery. And most of that march trail goes through Lowndes County. So I grew up with parents who I characterized as the jailhouse lawyers of our community. Everybody went to them when they had a problem and they tried to solve it. And we were like a big family, if you will. And the rural values that I learned, I mean, my parents planted their own food. Everybody would share from their gardens because everyone had a garden. And there was just this sense of community that we developed because it was part of our survival. And I still feel that when I go to Lowndes County today, because people can look in my face and tell that I'm a Coleman because of, the similarities and the connections that we have to that community. And I think that that's one of the things when we talk about America, I think rural America for too long has been left out of the equation because there are certain values that we have developed there and certain things around how we protect the earth have come out of there too, which has influenced my stances today because I've had those experiences.
We're speaking with Catherine Coleman Flowers, leading environmental activist, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and author of the new book, Holy Ground, on activism, environmental justice, and finding hope. And Catherine, you write about growing up poor in Lowndes County, and you say, and I'm quoting, "We knew we were poor, but we all believed that there was a way out. a way out of poverty, a way to prosper someplace else. The intention, though, was to come back home and bring that good fortune back to the community. The difference now is for many, there is no way out. Generational poverty is the norm rather than the exception. So, Catherine, can you talk about why, even though you grew up poor and had this belief that you could find a way out, that's not your assessment today? What do you think has happened?
I think that there are some institutions that have that actually profit from poverty. And as a result, they are not set up in such a way to help people grow or to help people develop what is needed to get out of poverty. It's, for an example, in a lot of rural communities, the salaries are low. If there are jobs there at all, people may be land rich, but they can't get a resilient or sustainable home, and they end up buying a mobile home. And a mobile home, I think, is a good example of that trap. A mobile home is like a car. When you pull it off the lot, it starts to depreciate in value, where most of us, when we build a house, the house increases in value. And that, to me, is one of the many ways in which people are trapped in poverty. A lot of poor rural communities don't have the tax base to support schools. And therefore, the salaries for teachers are low, so they don't get a chance to attract the best teachers. Where I grew up, we didn't have books. So, you know, the fact that at the time I grew up, which would date me, you know, my family, as poor as they were able to get on credit, Encyclopedia Britannica and World Book and Childcraft, which was the supplement to what I didn't have in school. But they also motivated me to want to read and to learn more and to get beyond where I was. A lot of children don't have that today.
When you talk about the political challenges, and in your book, you discuss how you spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. at some of the highest levels of power, interacting with U.S. senators, for example. You talk about working with former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, current Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville. And one of the things that becomes apparent is that these areas of rural poverty just simply do not have the political power, the political sway. Can you talk about that dynamic, how the challenges of what happens in rural America doesn't translate to the halls of power?
I think that what happens is that the people in rural America don't have the influence to hire lobbyists to lobby for them or to put money into the political coffers. And therefore, you know, what I believe happens is that people get there sometimes and they forget about the people that are voting for them. They'll show up and give them a little bit, but most of their efforts are elsewhere and not focusing on those areas. Now, when I met Jeff Sessions, it was because he was talking about these grants that were available to rural communities. He was at a town hall meeting. And at this town hall meeting, I raised the question, well, the grants are available, but most of these poor communities or these rural communities don't have the match to get the grant in the first place. How do we deal with that? He couldn't answer my question, but where I give him credit is that afterwards he came to me and said, I've always been concerned about that. I don't know what to do. And we start working together on that. And he told me that he grew up in rural Wilcox County, Alabama, and told me that he also grew up in poverty. So that was the common ground that we found, that we could talk about the things that we could agree on and agree to be disagreeable without alienating each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a great lesson that even someone as conservative, you know, early endorser of Trump, Senator Jeff Sessions, you know, ends up having a bit of a heart for what's happening in the rural parts of his state. And what are the lessons we can draw from that? I mean, it just seems like, you know, your community was fortunate that you were in a position to talk to Senator Sessions. Perhaps there's some good fortune that he had grew up in a similar impoverished background and had some empathy. But I mean, what can we do to try to make sure this isn't just kind of a one-off kind of situation, but something where systemically we're able to fix these problems?
I think that we have to have these hard conversations with folk without shouting at each other. We have to find some common ground. I mean, here, sometimes when I go into a community and I am not sure who I'm talking to, I just stick with the issues. You know, when I'm in a community and I'm talking about rural sanitation or sanitation in general, everybody agrees that each American should have access to sanitation, that sewage should not be on the ground. So I start with those common ground issues. And those common ground issues, out of that, we can develop some type of camaraderie and some type of friendship, maybe, to fight for those things that we both believe in. Because, you know, there may not be any... I'm concerned about the type of division that's existing in America, that we don't even talk to each other. And some people are now seeing that because they didn't talk to other folk or listen to other people or listen to the other side, that they now find themselves under the gun because they didn't pay attention. They didn't listen. And consequently, they're reaching out and wanting to build this camaraderie. But I think this is an opportunity for us to bring about some of the change that's necessary, especially in the South and in those rural communities that have been ignored and that have voted against their own interests.
Just want to remind listeners, you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're joined today by Catherine Coleman Flowers, leading environmental activist, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. In 2011, she worked with the UN Special Rapporteur to uncover the startling level of poverty in Lowndes County and the southern United States more broadly. And in 2021, she was appointed by the Biden administration to the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council to help guide the executive branch's response to climate change and environmental injustice. She's also the author of the new book we're talking today about, Holy Ground on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. And I want to open the phone lines as well. If you are from rural America and have thoughts about what could be done to try to address the inequities, the environmental injustice, if you've read our guest book and want to ask a question about it, the number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And also want to remind listeners that Catherine will be in San Francisco on Tuesday, February 25th for a noon event at the Commonwealth Club. And we have more information on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, Catherine, let's talk about one of these specific environmental injustices that you came across in Lowndes County, living there, but then coming back to work there as a consultant in economic development. And you talk about the living conditions of your neighbors, and specifically related to water and wastewater and water quality. Can you talk about when you found out about the failing water infrastructure in that community and the impact that that can have on communities more generally?
Well, initially, you know, growing up in Lowndes County, we had wastewater problems too, but we always thought it was a plumbing issue. We didn't think it was the on-site treatment from our septic system when the sewage came back into our homes. But it just so happened that I was entertaining a visitor who was coming from out of town to look at what could be done in Lowndes County to address some of the issues around poverty. And a county commissioner called me and said, "Catherine, you should go visit this family." And when we went there, the family, a husband and wife, had been arrested because their septic system was not functioning properly. And when we went to the area, we could actually see the raw sewage just rolling down the hillside, yeah, where the home was seated. And there were about 5 mobile homes there and a church. And when we got out of our cars and started walking toward the home, the pastor of the church came to us crying because he said that he could no longer have services at his church because he did not have a functioning septic system. So we didn't realize how big the problem was until later when we did a house-to-house survey. And we found out that it wasn't just poor families who could not afford on-site septic systems, but there are lots of failures. Failures mean there's sewage on top of the ground and you can see children's toys around it, or the sewage comes back into the home and usually comes back through a bathtub, and sometimes it floods the homes of the families that are impacted. And as we talk more and more about this, although people in Lowndes County were the first to reveal this problem, I've been hearing from people around the country, including in California, that either don't have sanitation at all at their homes, or they have failing systems. And we realize it's a technology problem, and it's a bigger problem than than folk care to acknowledge. And it's not only a problem here, it's a problem around the world. And as we deal with sea level rise and saltwater intrusion, high water tables that already exist in Lowndes County, for an example, we're going to have more and more problems with these technologies that have been failing for poor people in marginalized communities all the time, but they're starting to fail in other areas too.
Well, and it's an early indication that you got of a problem that made a lot of headlines once it happened in Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi, which you go into in some depth about in your book. And as you point out now, this is something that is really happening all over the United States. What do you see as the root causes of this kind of failing infrastructure, particularly here in, you know, one of the wealthiest countries on earth?
I think the first problem is was that marginalized communities have gotten the worst of the infrastructure that was available, if there was any kind of infrastructure investment at all. In most cases, there wasn't a really good, there wasn't the type of money that went into infrastructure in those rural communities as those more affluent communities. That's number one. But I think that what is becoming the equalizer in all this is climate change. Climate change is showing us and exposing the flaws of all of these infrastructures that have been sold to people that don't work, or the community that has profited from those sales don't want to change. They want to keep doing the same thing they've always done, and they're simply not working, and they're putting the public health at risk. So that's what I have seen, certainly around the U.S. And I think that large part of it is because the technology just is not working.
And you write in the book about back in 2019, in the lead up to the presidential election, the only candidate who visited Lowndes County was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And you write how in a small, poor, rural Southern community at that, the most basic show of respect requires one to pause, look, and listen. And that takes time. It sounds like Senator Sanders was able to do that to some extent. Can you talk about what came out of that, if anything, from that visit?
Yes, I think a lot came out of that. First of all, the fact that he wanted to come. And he wanted to come because the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, when he left the South, he went to Washington. And he got a chance to talk about what he saw in Lowndes County. And that's why Senator Sanders called me. But in addition to that, the other person that was part of that was Reverend Dr. William Barber. And Reverend Barber had invited one of the person whose home Senator Sanders visited, invited her to come and testify in Washington. And she testified about her experience as a poor mother of two children living in a mobile home that was worth much, much less than what they signed on the dotted line to pay for it, but was having problems. It was literally falling apart around her. And she also had raw sewage on the ground. Unfortunately, she passed away during COVID, but prior to that time, Senator Sanders visited her home. And after his visit, he said, "Catherine, I'm going to send help." And the way he sent help was by calling me when he withdrew from the presidential race and asked me to serve on the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force, where progressives and Biden supporters came together to try to come up with potential policies that could be part of a Biden administration. This was before he was elected. And one of the things that we talked about was environmental justice. I sat on the climate change task force and got a chance to work with people like John Kerry, AOC, Gina McCarthy, and others. And out of that came a focus on not only environmental justice more broadly, but made sanitation a part of that as well.
So it all starts with having that on the ground experience and getting the candidates to come down and pay attention and listen. We're speaking with Catherine Coleman Flowers, leading environmental activist, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and author of the new book, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls One Planet series. We're going to have much more to talk to Catherine about, so many more themes and anecdotes and vignettes and urgent needs that her book touches on. So stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more from Catherine Coleman Flowers. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, and if you have a show idea for us, you can send that over to us at yourcall@kalw.org. You can also call us anytime with any show ideas or questions. Number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Today's show, we are joined by Catherine Coleman Flowers, a leading environmental activist, founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. And in 2021, she was appointed by the Biden administration to the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, which helps guide the executive branch's response to climate change and environmental injustice. And she's the author of the new book we're discussing today, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. And she will be in San Francisco on Tuesday, February 25th, for a noon event at the Commonwealth Club. And we'll have information on our website, yourcallradio.org, if you would like to attend that event. And we also want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the elimination of environmental justice initiatives at the federal level? What questions do you have for our guests? You can join this conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Or if you have a comment, you can leave it on yourcallradio.org, our webpage. Well, Catherine, since you were serving on the Biden administration's White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, what happened when President Biden came in to address environmental injustice and also specifically some of these wastewater sanitation challenges that you've been working on your whole career?
Well, first of all, the WEJAC was instructed to help come up with ways in which to try to mitigate what had happened in terms of environmental injustice in communities around the country. And one of the things that it was clear about was that the data, I mean, what I learned through the process is the data is not there, then the government assumes that the issue does not exist. And I think that's a wrong formula, because that's how a lot of Americans get ignored over and over and over again. And I think that attests to what happens in rural America. People don't understand the interconnectedness with decisions that they make and how it impacts all of us, whether we're in an urban community or a rural community. And if they haven't spent time there, they don't know. So that's one of the things that became clear in my role as the co-vice chair of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. But to Biden's credit, he actually read a piece where I in the New York Times where I was quoted in an article talking about sanitation justice, and the only way we got voting rights was through federal intervention. The only way we were going to get sanitation justice was through federal intervention. And I received a call from his infrastructure czar saying that he wanted to make a difference. And they ended up sending the EPA administrator initially to Lowndes County to see the problem firsthand himself. And after that, they came up with a program called Closing the Wastewater Gap Initiative in Rural America, and they announced it in Lowndes County. At that announcement, it included the USDA Secretary, Tommy Vilsack. It also included the infrastructure czar, Mitch Landrieu, and EPA Administrator Michael Regan. And they announced this, and it covered not just Lowndes County, but 11 counties throughout the United States. And what was significant about this was that it was the first time the federal government acknowledged that there was a sanitation problem in rural America. That was significant. And then a year later, they announced that they were expanding to 100 counties. My concern is whether or not that will continue to happen or exist under the new administration, because the problem still exists.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. What is the latest now? I mean, there were a number of environmental justice initiatives that President Biden had announced. We know, of course, spending is frozen across much of the federal government, despite court orders to the contrary. What is happening now with this, much of the work that you were focused on and that the Biden administration was focused on with environmental justice?
I think the war continues. The work continues because as long as there's sewage on the ground in the United States of America, we'll never be great. So I am interested in seeing whether or not President Trump is going to not only visit those areas to see it firsthand for himself, but also have a constructive program and continue what was started to try to remedy this this problem that has been left neglected for many, many years in the United States.
Well, and as we were talking about earlier, you know, you have this history of really taking a bipartisan approach to this, working with former Senator Jeff Sessions. What has been some of the work you've done with the current senator, Senator Tommy Tuberville? What has been your outreach across the aisle and to those who are in a position to potentially help fix some of these challenges?
Well, the person I have to give credit for that meeting is actually Senator Cory Booker. So Senator Booker was on this agricultural committee, and they had a hearing about the Farm Bill and increasing funding. He wanted to increase funding for rural wastewater treatment. And he asked me, his staff contacted me and asked me, would I come and testify? And the person that, the highest rank, the person that I guess presided over the GOP side of this committee was Senator Tuberville. And when I went to the hearing, everybody was concerned about how we would interact. But what was interesting about this and what was telling to me is that there were actually more people on the GOP side that showed up for their hearing, more GOP senators, because a lot of their communities, their states are dealing with this very issue. In addition to that, there was an exchange between Senator Tuberville and Senator Booker. But prior to the hearing, I saw Senator Tuberville when he walked in, and I decided to go and introduce myself to him because my reception had been really good. The people that he had called to testify came up to me and said they supported the efforts that we had started around sanitation, actually to tell me that they too had lived in homes with failing septic systems. So when I went over to introduce myself to Senator Tuberville, I basically said to him, do you think it is fair that when a homeowner puts in a septic system that the liability is transferred to the homeowner and there's no warranty to protect them? And he said, I don't think that's fair. And then he had me turn around and we started taking pictures. There was a photographer there. He started taking these pictures with me, but we continued to talk. And I told him that, you know, I wanted to meet people in his office. And his people followed up with me after that, and I'm still in touch with people in his office. But the significant thing that came out of that is that Senators Tuberville and Booker actually had proposed to increase this amount. But at the end of the day, the Democrats were not initially supporting it because Tuberville was part of it. But sometimes we shouldn't cut off our noses to spite our faces. Yeah.
Well, it's such an interesting point that, you know, not many of these rural districts are represented by Republicans. Does that give you maybe some hope that there will be more bipartisan solutions to the challenges of rural poverty? And, you know, beyond that, does it give you some sense if we have this sort of bipartisan, a cause to work on this, that maybe it'll be a little less polarized, that the real work that affects people's lives maybe won't get caught up in a lot of the noise and a lot of the heated divisions?
Well, I think that we're seeing that now. What we're seeing here, you know, I am calling you from Huntsville, Alabama, and Huntsville has been in the news lately because of all, you know, the biggest employer in Huntsville is Redstone Arsenal. And based on what I've seen in the news, at least 7,000 people could lose their jobs. That's a lot of people. And we still don't know how that could impact the economy. Likewise, when you look at the fact that a lot of the farmers were impacted by the cuts by the cuts to USAID because what they were growing was being sent around the world to feed people. And now they're suffering as a result, because what I have found is that a lot of people that are making policy in Washington have never been to rural communities. They don't know what it's like to live in a rural community. They don't know how these farmers live. They don't know how close-knit these communities are. They don't even understand the interconnectedness to what is happening on the federal level to how it impacts the local level. And they're finding out now after they make the cuts. So consequently, how can they be making good policy when they don't even know the impact of what they're doing? And that's been, and in my view, that's been the problem all along. So maybe what can come out of this ultimately is that people will start talking to each other about how the things that they have thought was against their interests was actually supporting them. And how do we make sure that there's balance and that there is some form of equity when cuts are made, where it's not just billionaires getting contracts and the poor farmer or the middle class farmer either, because I think that poverty is relative. It depends on where you are. Even those farmers that are trying to survive can't survive because arbitrary decisions are being made that's impacting them. And it's not only impacting them economically, it's impacting our climate, it's impacting our environment.
We're speaking with Catherine Coleman Flowers, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. And in 2021, she was appointed by the Biden administration to the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council to help guide the executive branch's response to climate change and environmental injustice. And she's the author of the new book, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. And Catherine, as we think about what is happening in rural America, efforts by the Biden administration to try to address some of it, and of course, the funding freeze and rollback of so much of this work now under the second Trump administration. I mean, when you take a step back and think about the dynamics in this country and the injustices, what really should be happening? What, if you could wave a magic wand, what would you want to see happen to address these challenges?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, I actually wrote a piece recently for a newspaper in California where I talked about how we have a template for ending poverty. I mean, it happened during the New Deal and the Roosevelt administration. A lot of those programs that he put in place made it possible for people to buy homes, made it possible for people to maintain their business. We did some of that during the pandemic. Why can't we do it now? I mean, I think that at the end of the day, we have to find ways in which we can give people the opportunity to thrive. And that's everybody should have the opportunity to thrive. But what is happening when decisions are being made based on emotion or based on race in a negative way, based on segregationist policies, based on apartheid even, we're going to have problems, because that's not what America is all about. For me, being a veteran of the military and coming from a family where my father served in the military, my three brothers served in the military, we believed in the Constitution and the promise even when we didn't have access to it. We knew or felt it would come one day, and we continue to work toward that. And we have to do the same thing today. We cannot give up on democracy. When we give up on democracy, there will be no more America.
That's so true. And you know, as we look at this new presidential administration coming in, the second version of Trump, he's obviously issued so many directives, it's really hard to keep track of. But one that I wanted to ask you about that's been getting a bit of attention is a cancellation of a 31-year-old environmental justice directive that really threatens now the health of tens of millions of people in minority or low-income communities. This was a 1994 executive order by then-President Bill Clinton, and it removes a mandate that had survived four subsequent presidencies, including Trump's first term. This required federal agencies to address high and adverse, putting in quotes there, environmental and health effects of their decisions on areas with high rates of poverty or with large minority populations. So what do you see as the consequences of this specific decision to roll back this 31-year-old environmental justice directive?
Well, when I think about that, I think about West Virginia. And when I went through West Virginia, which is a beautiful state, and they were blowing the tops off of mountains to get to a vein of coal. And I think about the fact that my uncle died of black lung disease and how so many people were impacted by these kinds of decisions that are made. And we don't think about the long-term consequences. And we also think that it only impacts black communities when that is not true. There are a lot of white communities that are also impacted by these environmental injustices. And I think that with no type of parameters in place puts us all at risk.
And do
And
you think?
those people, and that is what I think is going to be the biggest challenge, is that folk think that just because they're white or just because they have money, that they won't be putting it in their backyard. But that pipeline might be going through their community where we're heretofore, that might not have happened. But I think we're dealing with a group of people now that at the end of the day, people are not put first, nor is the planet put first. Profit is put first.
Well, we're seeing that it seems like even more so now. And when we just look at living conditions in this country, more than 2 million Americans live without basic access to safe drinking water and sanitation. Native American households specifically are 19 times more likely than white households to lack indoor plumbing. And I'm wondering, as you kind of look around, you're just, deep in the trenches in a lot of these communities, but also at the national level, trying to remedy some of the infrastructure, basic living condition infrastructure challenges. How would you rate what is happening in this country now? Has the water sanitation problem improved? Have there been changes? What are some of the trends that you're seeing on this issue?
Well, the money has been frozen. Clearly, the work is not happening. That's one. And number two, I'm concerned. One of the essays I write is about Jackson, Mississippi. And the interesting thing about Jackson is that I went to Jackson, Mississippi. It was in December of 2023. And this was the day before I was in Jackson, the day before I went to Dubai. And what I found very interesting, when I went to Dubai, a country that's in a desert, but they had access to water, and they had some of the buildings and things that I saw in Dubai just defied imagination. And I wondered, what if we did the same thing here? But here we have a racialized view of looking at who should have infrastructure and who should not. And Jackson is a good example of that. Flint was another example of that. And I think we have to get past the point of using race as a social construct to deny people access to opportunity and the ability to thrive, or using it as an excuse to tell another group that's the reason why you're not thriving. Because it's not true. And at the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with investment and access to opportunity. Who gets access to education? Who gets access to the jobs? Who gets access to the infrastructure investment? Where's the government putting its money? And if we were to follow though, if we would follow all of this, I think we will see who's thriving and who's not. And in a lot of communities where there's more investment in prisons than there are in education, you can see what the outcome is going to be.
Well, this is such an important theme, really. I think for Democrats in particular, coming out of the election, a lot of the sort of early analysis is just how Democrats have lost touch with fighting for working class people in this country, that those issues were not top of mind for voters when they thought of Democrats. And so much of the infrastructure challenges comes from the poverty and the unequal distribution of wealth in this country. And so what would your advice be to how we could reframe our politics and try to address some of the root inequalities, the imbalance of wealth in this country that really gives, we see that manifested then in the infrastructure inequities, just as one example.
I would suggest that people go and visit their districts. And I don't mean having a Zoom meeting. I mean actually going and walking the streets and talking to people and visiting them in their homes, not something that's set up by the by their staffers for the purpose of having a photo op. because these are issues that exist. I went to South Texas, to the Colonias, where I saw where these are unincorporated communities, a lot of them without adequate sanitation, not even storm drainage, no lights outside. They don't even go outside at night because there are no lights. I mean, just the lack of investment. A lot of these people are American citizens and they're living in, and they're classified as rural communities, but it might be 2 or 3,000 trailers of homes, people living in those little areas, those little towns. But they're not classified as towns because they're unincorporated. There's been no real investment in those areas. And we have same thing when I went to parts of West Virginia. I saw the same thing. I saw poor white people there, and I said to them, "You know, you look just your situation reminds me of the situation I grew up in Lowndes County. We need to have an exchange program so we can see that we're not that different. We're the same, and we're treated the same. But the politicians have been skilled at providing divisions and making people think, well, you're like this because they're getting this, and that's not true." But at the end of the, if we look at, if we follow the dollar and figure out where the taxpayer money is going, a lot of it is not going to the people that need it and that are in this country who are taxpayers. And a lot of people that aren't paying taxes but are benefiting are getting the dole. And we have to find a way to make it more equal, and we have to find a way to make sure that everybody in this country gets to thrive.
And Catherine, what's your advice for people in the communities like the one that you grew up with, grew up in, and still work with, for those leaders, those local leaders, those sort of the young Catherine Coleman Flowers? What would you say for advice?
Don't give up. That would be my advice. Don't give up. And I would advise them to read the Constitution and make it work. Because a lot of the people that are making decisions now have not read or understand the Constitution. They don't understand separations of power. They don't understand there are three branches of government. They don't even understand how we can have dissent and still be together as a nation. They don't want people to speak against them. But I think at the end of the day, they should be the ones that go out into the community and lift up the stories of what's happening there so people can see what the truth is. And I think ultimately the truth will win and people will start turning away from false gods and false promises that at the end of the day, the only purpose is to tear up America, not to make America great again.
And Catherine, where do you find hope? Where do you look to for support, strength? What is your advice for maintaining hope in this time?
My faith, you know, my faith has carried me through some dark times. I have, in the book, I talk about some of those times that I've had to encounter, and even when I had to make decisions, where I put myself second instead of first, because I was more concerned about the community. But that's because I have examples, that have come from my faith tradition. And I still call on my faith tradition whenever I deal with a hard time. And I always encourage people, no matter what your faith is, to believe in a power higher than yourself, because it'll give you the hope that you need to get to the other side.
And Catherine, what's next for you? Do you have other policy projects, writing projects?
Well, hopefully, we're looking at the possibility of either a feature film or a series around the work in my life. I'm also looking at eventually doing a third book, and just continuing to do the work as long as I have the ability to physically get out there and do it, to keep doing it and lifting up the stories of rural communities so we can find some tangible solutions.
Well, we'll have to have you back on for any and all of those projects if and when they come together. And I want to thank you not only for the good work that you're doing on the ground to raise issues that are just so often overlooked of environmental injustice, but also, of course, for coming on our program today, Catherine Coleman Flowers, leading environmental activist, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and author of the new book, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. Thank you so much for coming on our program today, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
And for listeners who want to hear more from Catherine, she will be in San Francisco on Tuesday, February 25th for a noon event at the Commonwealth Club. And you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org and the book again, Holy Ground on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. That is our show today. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. We always appreciate that. And of course, we're on social media. Just look for Your Call Radio, and you can email any show ideas and feedback you have to us at yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.